Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 248, and we're going to talk about 10 things to be afraid of. That's right. What are the actual things you should be afraid of when you're living in your van? We're also going to talk about visiting Canada as an American. Want to take your van to the Great White North? Here's some things you could consider. We'll have a tale from the road involving a very bad day becoming a pretty good day. And we're going to review 3M security film. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. Very nice to have you. So I'm going to say here that some of you have concerns about van life. In fact, there's a large YouTube presence of things that can happen in van life that are horrible, and new people who are considering this, you know, say, oh, lions and tigers and bears, and it's horrible out there, and I'm never going to leave my house. And well, we are going to take some time to try to take a rational look at the things you actually should be afraid of versus the things that they're really not as scary as it might seem. And I've done a bit of research on this, and I'm pretty confident I have a good list here. So I'm going to start with the lowest risk things. Now, before I start, it might be a good exercise for you to think, what do you think the most dangerous parts of van life are? I mean, all right, you don't have to make a list of 10, but take a moment and come up with a few and think about, you know, what are like the top three? What are the top three things that you think are the most dangerous in van life? What things could happen to you while you're doing van life that are the scariest, most dangerous things? Okay, lock that list in. Is that your final answer? Yes, it's your final answer because I can't hear you, so I'm making it your final answer. So here we go. Starting at the lowest risk of my list of 10. Number one, well, it should be number 10, but the way I've got the sheet here, number one is the lowest, number 10 is the highest. We're going to go with that. So number one, the lowest risk of things that are actually risk here is exposure to the elements. Yeah, you know, weather can be a problem. I hear a lot of people talking about like what happens if a tornado comes. They're worried about hailstorms and things like that. Absolutely, those are concerns. Floods, there's a lot of stuff out there in the environment that can be harmful, and you should pay close attention to it. But the number of van lifers that are affected by those things is pretty small, and you generally will have warning. Now, not always. You know, tornadoes can just happen. If a dam breaks and everything floods, well, there's probably not much warning about that. But if you're going to go camping in Montana in February, you are probably prepared for things like extended periods of cold and blizzards and things like that. So this is something that you can overcome. And as it happens, it's just not all that risky in the grand scheme of things. Number two, a real concern, and one that comes up all the time when people are talking about whether it's safe to do van life, is human threats. Yeah, believe it or not, humans are a problem, right? I mean, sure, there's bad things that happen. Wait till we get to the news section, and I'll give you a terrible example. But yeah, people can be dangerous. You know, there's that thing, you know, if a woman's alone in the woods, would they rather meet a man or a bear? And so many of them chose bears. Well, that's because there's this sense that people are dangerous, and they absolutely can be. But I hear a lot more stories about how people are really helpful. You know, one bad guy who does something terrible is going to create ripples in the pond of news that spread from edge to edge and go back and forth. But the guy who helps someone change a tire or who loans somebody $20 or whatever doesn't even appear. You never hear about it. A few friends might say, oh, I met this nice guy, he helped me out, but that's it. It's not going to make the news or anything. And those interactions are actually a lot more common. So it's important to maintain perspective there. I've been traveling around the country in a van for years. I've been to every state. The number of negative interactions I've had with people, pretty low. And the number of dangerous interactions I've had with people, obviously, I'm coming to you as an older white male of some size, but still, pretty small. I've been threatened twice in my 50 8 years. Well, as an adult, we're going to put school aside, but yes, as an adult, I've been threatened twice. Once, actually, both times because of the t-shirt I was wearing. And actually, maybe I'll save the story of one of those t-shirts for another time. But one of the shirts I was wearing was a shirt of the Union Jack, the British flag. And someone in Texas saw me wearing that shirt and got all offended, which I thought was very strange. However, the risk is low. It really is. It is not the way it appears. If someone on YouTube posts, you know, attacked or something, everybody watches that video. But it's actually pretty rare. Number three. Home invasion robbery, as in someone's trying to break in your van. It's never happened to me. I do know people it's happened to, but it's not that common. Generally, people who break into vehicles don't want there to be anyone in the vehicle. So while you're sleeping in your vehicle, if somebody starts breaking in your vehicle and finds out that you're in there, almost all of the time, they're going to run away. They're just trying to smash and grab whatever they can. You know, if they see, like, you've got a Jackery on the front seat or something, they might try to smash and grab that. That happens. It happens in some places more than others, yes. But people are, I think, over-concerned about that risk. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take precautions. I'm not saying just leave all your stuff out there and leave your doors unlocked. Although, interestingly, that is a strategy. If you leave your doors unlocked, that means they won't smash your windows to take things. So there's a little weird math there. You make it easy for them to get in there and they won't break your stuff. Yeah, anyway, I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying that's something to think about. But so it happens, but just not as often as you think. All the travels I've done in all my vans and all my RVs, I've never had anyone try to break in my van or anyone steal anything from my van or my campsite. Once while I was driving my car, I did have somebody go into my car while I was in a 7-Eleven and steal all the change that was in this little pocket. I had a, you know, like a pocket of toll change, and I didn't lock the car because I was just running into 7-Eleven, and when I came out, all that change was gone. It's pretty low-level crime, but still, I think that's the worst that's ever happened to me in that regard. Now, I have had vehicles broken into that were parked, but if your concern is that someone's going to break into your vehicle while you're sleeping in it, that rarely happens, and almost every time it does, well, they're just going to run away when they find out you're there. And if you have a dog, well, yeah, you're probably not going to have that. Number four, the last one in the lowest risk, is wild animal encounters. I mean, yeah, you have to be careful about what you're going to encounter out there, especially if you're going to be camping in the North Woods or something like that. Bear spray is a good idea. I recommend that everybody have bear spray. It can be used for a few different things, and it's very effective against bears. But the chances of you having an incident with a bear is actually pretty small. It's definitely higher in other places, but like, look at people like Forrest C. Forrest. He's out there in the booniest of boonies, living literally in bear country. And I don't believe he's ever had a problem with a bear. And he's cooking away in his van. He's got a dog. He's got all these kind of things that could be attractive to a bear. He's never had a problem, and he's right in the middle of it. Yes, things can happen if you're in a campground that has had a lot of different people stay in it, and they have been very poor about taking care of their food, and bears get habituated. Yeah, that's when you're going to have bears trying to break into your car. But it's really not as common as they might make you think. That said, it's pretty easy to take precautions, and there's no reason why you shouldn't. Okay, now we're going to get into the moderate risk category. These next three are more common, and they're a bit more serious. Number five, getting stranded. You're in a vehicle, it's mechanical, things can go wrong, and while I've often said that the best thing to break down in is a camper van, because, you know, you're broken down in your house, oh no, well, it's still a problem. You know, where you're broken down could not be ideal, and getting help could be a big problem. I mean, we, you know, okay, cell phone service is a lot better and stuff, but there are definitely places where you can't get cell phone service. Now, if you've got an iPhone, you can send satellite messages and stuff, and if you have a Garmin inReach, you can get help. Yeah, all that's true. But getting stranded is actually fairly risky. And there are some amazing stories out there of terrible things that have happened to people who've gotten stranded. The German tourists come to mind. If you're not familiar with the German tourists, just search Death Valley German tourists. That's an amazing story. There have been a few cases where people got lost during blizzards and ended up driving on roads that were closed. You know, there's all kinds of things like that. So getting stranded is a concern, especially if it's very, very cold out. So that's an easy thing to take precautions against, too. Make sure you have a way to stay warm in the winter. Even if you don't plan on going outside, make sure you have a coat and blankets, some water and food with you all the time. And you're going to mitigate a lot of the risks of getting stranded. But it's actually a fairly good risk. Number six. Physical injury. Yeah, absolutely. You know, van life is a very active thing. You're up on your roof cleaning your solar panels, you fall off, you break your leg, you can't move. And if you're in downtown Chicago, well, that's terrible, but somebody's going to find you and take you to the ER. But if you're on a remote road in Death Valley and it's 9 p.m., you're going to be spending the night in Death Valley with a broken leg. So that's an actually serious thing that happens often, and you do have to be concerned about it. So what can you do? I mean, well, you can have a well-prepared first aid kit for van life, which is probably not something you bought off the shelf. This is something that you did research on, and you filled the kit with the things that are actually important to van life. You know, not the bacitracin and not the bandages. You want things like stop the bleed kits and splints and things like that that are actually going to help you get out of there. And you're going to want to let people know where you are. I mean, I'm all a fan of being the rugged individualist and heading out there all by myself, but you're foolish if you don't have somebody who knows where you are and you have a schedule of communicating with them where you're going to check in every so often. And they should have instructions on what to do if you don't check in. I mean, that's a part that's often forgotten. You know, make sure you check in, okay, and then they don't check in and you're like, oh, now what? Well, give them instructions, you know, give them the general idea of where you're going to be and tell them who to call if you get stuck. So that's a real concern. And we're out there with axes and all kinds of crazy things. Your risk of getting physically injured is actually greater than anything else we've listed on this list. Number seven is getting lost. Getting lost while hiking, getting lost while going for a walk, getting lost while you're in your van. If you're on pavement, it seems fairly impossible these days with all the resources we have, but getting lost can be very serious. See again the German tourists. If you are driving off-road and you don't have cell phone service, you really need to know where you're going. I famously got lost in Death Valley once. I drove up the Lippincott Trail over Ubahibe and down into Racetrack Playa. And then I don't exactly know what I did, but when I left from there, I went the wrong way. And I ended up just in the desert. I had completely lost any sense of where there was any road. And I noticed there was snow around me, which I hadn't seen snow in this whole trip, which told me I was actually gaining altitude, which was not something I wanted when I was looking for civilization. And I noticed that my gas gauge was going down. It takes a lot of gas driving in Death Valley, by the way. You're not going to be getting your 20 miles a gallon out there. You know, you really need to scale that back. But I got lucky. Eventually, I just drove around until I found a trail, and I generally followed it downhill, and I ended up on a road to Pahrump, which was fine. Pahrump I could deal with. But very scary moment, and I was stupid. I was completely ill-prepared, and it's only through dumb luck that I didn't have a much larger adventure to tell. So, you know, when you're out there exploring, by all means explore, but have some sense of where you are and have the tools needed to figure that out. A compass is not a foolish thing to have. Paper maps are still good. And a general understanding of how you can determine where you are, regardless of all your electronics and stuff. Don't do what I did, which is just go out there and trust the GPS and then get lost, because I really could have ended up like the German tourists. I mean, maybe not, because I was in a Jeep and they were in a minivan, but still, it could have been very, very bad. And now, this is the stuff that is actually really dangerous that is very common and that everybody needs to do something about. These three things, if these weren't on your list that you made, you need to reassess what's actually dangerous in van life. So number eight, which calls back to last week, fire. Yeah, fire's dangerous. You know, it's a tool. We can manage it. We can use it for things, but it's actually very dangerous. And there's plenty of videos of people's vans burning down. You have to take fire seriously. This is why I say of two things that you should buy as soon as you start building out a van, a fire extinguisher is one of them. And practice with it. I don't mean you actually have to pull the pin and squeeze the trigger and stuff. I mean practice scenarios where, like, you're asleep in bed and there's a fire. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Quick, think. Because just that doing it fake will help your brain do the right thing when it's time. I've experienced this myself. Those little training things do help a lot. And of course, what you're going to do is you're going to get up and grab the fire extinguisher and then evaluate. And then when you use the fire extinguisher, you're going to spray the base back and forth in a sweeping motion, etc. Make sure you spend some time learning that. Also, respect the fire. If your van's on fire, get the hell away from it. If you can't put it out very, very quickly, let it go. Save yourself. Get out of there. Call the fire department. Call 911. Absolutely, you want to do that. But you don't want to be a hero saving physical possessions. It isn't worth it. Every single thing there, no matter how much time and work you put into it, can be replaced. Let it go. Number nine, carbon monoxide poisoning. You hear stories about it. People die from it every year. And why is that? Because people don't think it's as dangerous as it is. Imagine this. You've got a propane heater and your brother hooked it up. You don't really know how it works. Doesn't matter. It's giving off heat and it's a really cold night. So you close everything up tight and you go to bed. The next thing that happens, well, you don't know because you're dead. You don't know what the next thing is because carbon monoxide gets into your body and binds with your hemoglobin such that oxygen can no longer bind with your hemoglobin. In fact, carbon monoxide is better at binding than oxygen, and you suffocate, but you don't even know it. Kills people every year. We don't actually hear enough about it as much as we do here. So you absolutely are going to buy a carbon monoxide detector with your fire extinguisher, and even before you build out your van, you're going to stick it in there. Absolutely. This is one of the things that people are far less scared of than they should be. If you are driving around camping with propane or anything that's combustible, like, you know, you have a gas engine, well, there's your combustion right there, and you don't have a carbon monoxide detector, you are risking yourself for no reason. Now, just to quickly answer the question as to where should you put the carbon monoxide detector, the best advice right now is you want to put it at the same level as your head when you're sleeping. The logic there is that carbon monoxide and air are almost the same. And yes, while carbon monoxide might actually be a little higher in your stratosphere there because it's hot, you can't guarantee that. But what you can guarantee is if there's carbon monoxide at the same level that you're breathing at, it's bad. So get a carbon monoxide detector. That is a real risk that you really should be worried about. And number 10, did you guess what it is? Because I haven't mentioned it yet. You should have. Vehicular accidents. The most dangerous thing you're going to do in your van is drive it. Absolutely true. Driving is really very dangerous. It's one of the most dangerous things that everybody does. And, you know, if you think about it, I think about this a lot, actually. It's night, and you're driving down a two-lane road, but it's rural, so everyone's doing 60, 65, and you go around a corner, and there's another car coming, or a truck, or whatever. All they have to do is turn their steering wheel like an eighth of a turn, just zoop, and they're going to smash into you and kill you. You're trusting a stranger to hold a wheel in the right place and not be distracted by a dog jumping on their lap or dropping a cigarette or whatever. Your life depends on that. So driving is actually very dangerous. And what can you do about that? Well, you try to drive defensively yourself. You become a good driver, an attentive driver. You always wear your seatbelt. And that's all I got for you. I mean, driving's inherently dangerous. Vehicles are much, much safer now. Newer vehicles are safer than older vehicles. They're, you know, if you're driving that 1981 Econoline, I'm sorry, you're much less safe in this regard than if you're driving the 2022 Ford Transit. But still, that's what's going to hurt you. So, when you were thinking about van life, what was the thing you were most afraid of? And I'm almost positive that it wasn't accidents. That wasn't the thing that was on your mind, probably because we face that all the time, and we have ever since we started moving about and driving and riding in people's cars. But it's actually the most dangerous thing. So just trying to put some things in perspective here. If you're up late at night because you're afraid someone's going to break into your van and do something to you, that is not rational. It's very, very, very unlikely that that's going to happen. But if you're just cavalier about accidents, well, you maybe should think about it a bit more, because that's the thing that's likely to get you. Thanks to everyone who has supported this program by visiting buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. This is a way that you can buy me a gallon of diesel, and that will prevent ads from appearing in the podcast, which makes me happy, and it makes you happy, and everybody's happy. Special thanks to those of you who donate every month. I absolutely appreciate you. If you would like to help out, visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And we all thank you. Van Life News. Okay, keep looking for that good news out there, and it's not so easy to find, but I do actually have a little bit here. So I've got 3 news items. First off, sent to me by a listener. Thank you very much. Arizona State Parks are raising their fees, and I think this is going to be a theme we're going to be seeing everywhere. And the bottom line is that camping's going to be more expensive this year. It's going to be very chaotic, and I'm referring to the kind of camping that you actually have to pay for and stuff. So yeah, they've announced that they're raising their rates a lot, and there's a link in the show notes. If you're interested in camping at state parks in Arizona, you should definitely look at it. But annual passes now are $75, and that's with restrictions. If you want the premium pass, it's $200 a year. Camping fees at a rustic, aka no hookup site, are going to be between $25 and $75. Yeah, you can pay $75 a night for basically a place to park, although that one will have full hookups, the high one. So day use fees are between $10 and $30, just if you want to go visit the place. Karchner Cavern State Park is raising the visit price from $23 to $30, and so on and so forth. Every single thing that the state controls has basically gone up. So if you were thinking about visiting Arizona this year, which I recommend you do, Arizona is absolutely beautiful, be prepared to pay a little bit more if you're going to be visiting the state park system. And thank you for sending me that link. Next, and I don't want to talk about this. I'm going to say this flat out, and then I'm going to move on. Gabby Petito, who is or was a van lifer who had a tragic end that was all over the news in the van life community, well, there's now a docuseries about her life and death on Netflix. And this docuseries, which I have not watched and I probably will not, documents things from the perspective of Gabby's family and not her boyfriend's family. Her boyfriend's family, they're apparently very upset about this, whatever. But if you would like to see some more about what happened to Gabby Petito, I will have a link in the show notes. It's on Netflix. It's pretty easy to find. Again, I do not think the Gabby Petito story is a van life story. There was a van involved. They were doing van life, but I don't think the story has anything to say about van life. It's just a very sad, tragic story. And then number 3, which I consider good news, VanFest Cape Cod has been announced. I am very excited about this. The thought of having a van life event in New England thrills me, and I'm going to try to go. I can't commit yet. My year is all screwed up because of the surgery and everything else. It's a crazy year, so I'm going to try. But just because I may or may not be there doesn't mean you shouldn't try, and you can get tickets now. It just opened up. So this is at the Cape Cod Fairgrounds in East Falmouth, Massachusetts, which is kind of, if you're familiar with Cape Cod, that's fairly near the armpit or the elbow, depending on how you look at it, but it's near the mainland. It's not too far down the Cape. And it's going to be from August 21st to 25th, 2025, and it's going to be like the other VanFest events. They're going to have tons of vans there, and you can tour the vans, and there will be probably food trucks, and you're going to have some lectures and demonstrations on stuff, and you can buy things for your van, and all that kind of stuff, all the normal stuff. But this event has something I've never heard of at a van life event before, and that is flush toilets. Yes, they have flush toilets at this site, which can actually be a pretty big deal. So that's excellent, and I really hope to get to go. And if I can, I'll give a few talks and stuff, and I'll bring my van or one of my vehicles. I don't know, but we'll see. I can't commit yet. I really want to. Tech Talk. So I got a message. I'm gonna not tell you who this person is because I'm gonna maintain their privacy. But this person owns a 2011 Dodge Caravan, and they were having this weird problem. And the problem was they were just sitting there in the van and turned the van on, and the windows started rolling up and down, and the doors kept locking and unlocking just kind of randomly. And it wasn't like anyone was leaning on a button or anything. If they turned the van off, it still did these things. So they contacted me concerned, and absolutely, this is weird, and asked me if there was somehow their electrical system that they built was doing this or whatever. And time out here. What do you think would cause that? I mean, my first thought was that the body module, which is the computer in Dodge Caravans that controls all this kind of stuff, somehow got wet. It's a 14-year-old van, you know, and I happen to know this van has spent most of its life up north where it's going to encounter salt and things like that. So I was thinking, oh no, body modules are fairly expensive to replace. And it would have been a bad day for that van had that actually been the problem. And I was trying to think about how to troubleshoot that. And then I thought, wait. I've heard of this before. So I asked her to do something that might seem counterintuitive. And she was a bit resistant at first, but I asked her to clean her key fob. That's right, her key fob. Now, she didn't think of the key fob because while the key fob obviously can lock and unlock the door, key fob's not going to make the windows go down. Ah, but yes, it is. You see, there's a hidden feature on Dodge Caravan key fobs. Most of them, not all of them. And if you have a Dodge Caravan, you can try this. But if you press a certain pattern onto the key fob, it will roll the windows down. And the reason that feature is there is so on really hot days, you can roll the windows down and let all the heat out before you get in there and start the air conditioning. So it's a feature. It's just that Dodge didn't like put a window button on the key fob. It's just you got to do these things. So the way you do it, and again, I don't have a Dodge Caravan. I can't test this out, but this is what I'm getting from the internet is you press your lock button three times. 1, 2, 3. Then press your panic button once. And then press the unlock button again. And then you press and hold down your unlock button. Did you get all that? Press your lock button three times. Press your panic button once. Press your unlock button again. Then press and hold down your unlock button. I don't know why they came up with this crazy pattern. If you're like trying to have a feature, that's bizarre. But that apparently is the code for it. And it'll make your windows roll down. And so what had happened in her case is her key fob, which is 14 years old, had seen some things. It had been through a life and it was, you know, kind of a little dirty, a little damaged. And the contacts were all messed up in there. So when she opened it and cleaned it out and closed it, the problem was solved. It was a free fix just because of the key fob. So I tell you this for a couple of reasons. If you have a Dodge Caravan, hey, you've got this new magic power you didn't know about, and I would recommend you Google it or go on YouTube and see how it works. Don't try to follow the instructions I gave, but heck, they might work. Also, if you have a Dodge truck, these same codes may work on that truck too. It's a whole new world out there of hidden fob codes. But know that if you have a Dodge Caravan, your key fob can get damaged and actually cause weird symptoms, and it's not necessarily intuitive to think of the key fob when you're in the car, you think it's the car. But yeah, it could actually be the key fob. So just file that away because while it may not fix the problem, it's a very easy, cheap thing to look at. And quite often, looking at the easy, cheap solutions are the first thing you should do, even if they're not the most likely solution. Because, heck, if that's what it is, you're going to save yourself a whole lot of time and money by checking it first. Anyway, thank you, anonymous person, for sharing that story. And I'm very happy that my little bit of knowledge about that was able to get you back on the road. Product review. So I've not tried this product, but I want you to be aware of it. So I'm reviewing it the best I can as someone who's never actually tried the product. But it is called 3M Security Film. Yes, 3M Security Film. And you can think of it like a tint. It's a tint you can put on your windows, except it doesn't really tint the windows. It just adds security. And when I say it adds security, I mean it has a lot of security. You can throw a brick at a window with 3M security film, and the brick will not go through the window. Now, the window will break, but the film is going to keep it solid. So if somebody came up to your van and tried to break in with a brick, they could pound away on it, and they would not get the glass to break away enough for them to stick their hand in there. Now, eventually, they're going to get through. But the point is that at that point, they're making a lot of noise, and they're probably spooked, and they're going to run away. And yeah, this stuff can actually do that. Now, you can buy knockoff stuff that you can install yourself for much less money, but the reviews of it aren't really that good. So I think this is something you're going to have professionally installed, and it's not cheap. It's about $350 a window. And typically what people do is they will do the front and passenger windows of their van, and that's it, because those are the two places people tend to break in. And yeah, this works. This is definitely something that will keep people from smashing your windows and getting in your van. And if that is what you want, this is the stuff. But I do have one thing for you to consider. If you're in an accident and they need to get you out of the van and they're having trouble opening the doors, usually what the first responders will do is break the glass to get you out. And they won't be able to do that. So you're a little less safe in case of an accident. I'm sure the first responders have had training on this, but bystanders who are trying to help out may not. So that can be a small problem. But other than that, I can tell you that this stuff actually does work. And well, if you're really worried about that, for $700, you can have this film applied professionally, and that will keep people from being able to break your windows and get in your van. They're still going to break your windows. I mean, your window's gone. There's nothing you can do about that. You're going to have to replace the window and then replace the security film. So if anybody does that, you're out $350 more than if they hadn't. But if you've got like expensive stuff in your van, heck, it might be worth it. So I don't have a link or anything. You can just Google 3M security film and see what's out there. But it seems like magic. But the stuff actually does really work. Tales from the road. So, my friend Liz James, I will say her name. I've said it here before, and I will keep saying it because she keeps doing wonderful things. She had a bad van life moment, and she shared it on Facebook, and it was awesome. So I asked her to turn it into a story, a tale from the road. So this time, this tale from the road actually belongs to Liz. And here's Liz.
Hi, Jeff. I have a tale from the road that I think you might like. So I arrived back at Serenity the van after a weekend of contra dancing and discovered she had been plowed in, but not with snow, with what had been slush at the time of the plowing and was now solid ice up to the hubcaps. So fortunately, with my credit card, I do have roadside assistance. I called roadside assistance. Quite predictably, they were mobbed and couldn't send someone until the afternoon. It was quite early morning at the time. And also, they told me that for them to help, the vehicle would need to be winchable, which meant free of ice around the wheels. So I had a problem to solve, which, to be honest, I had no idea how to solve, not having lived in a place where slushy plowing is a real problem. So I felt alone and kind of scared. And then I reminded myself I am an independent, intrepid van lifer and a listener of Built to Go. And I've listened to you, Jeff, work problems before. So I thought, I'm not going to panic. What are my options? I didn't really have much to chip ice with. I had a metal piece that was had been a piece of the trailer hitch. And there wasn't really a way to get to a store. There was no transit in this town to get better tools. So I thought, okay, my options are to start chipping with what I have and see what I can do. On the plus side, I had a lot of hours before the tow truck could arrive. So I started chipping away. And I was pretty cold and pretty miserable and pretty convinced this was one of the worst days of van life. But at least I thought to myself, I might end up with a great story for the Bill to Go podcast. So I tried to keep myself in good spirits. So as I'm chipping away, a woman comes and introduces herself to me as Rosalie. She's in the car behind me. In front of me is the exit of a driveway, so I could just drive away. She could have driven away on solid pavement, but on ice where you have to like gun and push, she would have hit the back of my car. So she couldn't leave until I could leave. So Rosalie, who looks to me like about 12, but must have at least been 16, also has absolutely no idea what to do. But she says she can't leave until I can leave, so how about she's going to help me with my van? She didn't ask for anything in return. I volunteered that I will stay and help her with her car. She has no way of knowing that I'm actually going to do this, but I definitely am. So I explain about the winchable thing, and we both start chipping. She's got no gloves and a kind of crummy folding shovel. I have an extra pair of gloves, so I lend her a pair of gloves, and we pull out the Reflectix from my van to kneel on so that we don't get our knees wet. And now we're sort of starting to feel like part of a team, which was a lot more fun than where I was before and maybe slightly more effective, but both of us really don't know what we're doing. So at some point, Rosalie gets on the phone with her mom, who suggests that we pour boiling water, which I'm a little nervous about because after boiling water cools off, it freezes, but we're going to try that. That's what they did in New York, her mom says. So we go up to the Airbnb, which I've checked out of but still know the code for, boil some water, and that does seem to sort of help. Rosalie goes up for a second thing of boiling water, and then on the way down, unbeknownst to me, finds someone else who's stuck and starts helping them, pours boiling water with them, helps them push. They get out, this is about a block away, and they drive up to us, and they give us the shovel that they got from the fire department and tell us where to return it. So now we have a legit tool, and two of us, so already things are improving a lot. And then after a little bit, the two women in the cars behind us, there's two more cars behind Rosalie's, the last of which could back up and get free, arrive. And of course, Rosalie goes and introduces herself to them and tells them what we've learned so far and offers to help with the shoveling. And the last one is, her name I think was Mackenzie. And Mackenzie has an appointment. So Rosalie and I, who have hours and hours to do our chipping, head out and start helping Mackenzie with her car. Mackenzie's dad and someone who was like a relative or a neighbor have arrived by this point. And so they're helping and they have a whole bunch of tools. So now things are a lot more effective. And it's more effective because six people getting out one car, you've got five pushers. So you don't have to get nearly as clear before you can start shoving. So that's also making a huge difference. And we're at the point where as we get each car out, we've learned more about what's effective instead of me by myself chipping with this trailer hitch. But more than that, there was this sense of like, we are on a team working against a problem, which was really fun. At one point, I'm shoveling and I'm thinking, I am not actually miserable. I don't feel cold anymore. I don't feel wet. I feel excited about being with a team in the sunshine, getting exercise in the open air with a goal that we're working on together. It was actually quite fun. So by the time we got the last car free, everybody stayed to help when their cars got free. The last car to get free was mine, and everybody was cheering, and we took pictures. I took a picture of Rosalie with the trailer hitch, and everybody with hugs all around. And I realized the day was transformed. I was prepared for this is going to be one of the worst days of van life, and this is one of my favorite stories from the road. And I have Rosalie to thank for that, who was even more lost than I was and had no idea what to do. And her instinct was, well, I'm going to build a community out of people that have the same problem, and we'll tackle that problem together. And she transformed what could have been a lot of solitary, miserable people chipping away at their own cars into this effective, fun team sport, and at the end, team celebration. So shout out to Rosalie.
Wow, thank you, Liz. Now, in her Facebook post, she said the way she ended it was, there are good days and bad days in van life. There are so bad I have to remind myself that I'm an independent and can solve problem days. And then there are so good I can't resist telling you about it days. This was a so good I can't resist telling you about it day in the end. I love that. So, Liz, thank you so much for sharing that with us. What a great story, and what a great experience you had. And while you're giving all the credit to Rosalie, which I think is fine, I know you had a lot to do with what happened there that day. So, good on you. I'll have a link in the show notes if anybody would like to actually read the story on Facebook. A place to visit. Okay, folks, we're going to do an experiment here, and this is going to annoy some of you, and I apologize, but what's happened is someone has asked me about van life in Canada. And while I have done a little bit of van life in Canada, I am by no means an expert. And I thought maybe I should ask somebody else how to do this. Now, I do know several Canadians, and if anyone listening is from Canada and would like to give advice to a USAEN who would like to do van life in Canada, I would absolutely be happy to pass that along. However, I'm not that prepared, so I'm going to ask a different kind of expert, and we shall see what they say.
Hey, Jeff.
I would like to talk about Americans doing van life in Canada.
Sure thing, Jeff. It's becoming a trend for Americans seeking adventure and nature. Canada's vast landscapes offer plenty of room for exploration. People are drawn to the freedom of the open road and the beauty of Canada's wilderness.
So what are some of the best places to visit?
Canada's vast landscape offers many gems for van life. Banff and Jasper National Parks in Alberta, the Cabot Trail in Nova Scotia, and the Sea to Sky Highway in British Columbia are top picks. Each offers stunning scenery and unique experiences.
Well, those all sound great, but you know, I'm a little worried that gas prices are going to be a problem. Just how bad is gas up in Canada?
Let's check the latest gas prices in Canada. In Canada, as of February 2025, the average gasoline price is around $1.82 per liter. It's a bit on the higher side compared to the global average. So, yeah, fuel costs could add up.
And what is $1.82 per liter in gallons?
Since one U.S. gallon is approximately 3.785 liters, multiplying 1.82 Canadian dollars by 3.785 gives you 6.88 Canadian dollars per gallon.
Okay, so it could be as much as $7 a gallon for gas in Canada.
Exactly. Depending on the province, it could be around $7 a gallon. Definitely something to budget for on your van life adventure.
Now, I've heard that people need to take special care about wildlife in Canada. Is that true?
Absolutely. Canada's vast wilderness means you could encounter bears, moose, or other wildlife, especially in national parks. It's important to follow guidelines for safe, respectful distance, and proper food storage to avoid attracting animals.
What do you think the Canadians' attitude would be towards American van lifers?
Canadians are generally known for their friendliness and hospitality, so as long as visitors are respectful of local customs and the environment, they're likely to be welcomed. They might be curious about the van life experience and eager to share tips on enjoying Canada's natural beauty.
Can you tell me what the Crown Lands are?
Crown land refers to areas owned by the government, mainly for public and conservation use. In Canada, this includes vast natural areas where camping and outdoor activities are permitted, often for free or with minimal fees.
So is it kind of like BLM land in the U.S.?
Yes, very similar. Crown land in Canada is akin to BLM land in the U.S., offering vast areas for public use, like camping, hiking, and fishing, often with fewer restrictions and more natural settings.
So how hard is it to do border crossings? Are they especially tricky with vans?
Crossing the border into Canada with a van isn't overly complicated, but you should be prepared. Have all necessary documentation, declare any items you're bringing, and be ready for inspection. It might take a bit longer with a van due to extra storage areas, but it's manageable with the right prep.
Well, thank you very much, co-pilot. That was excellent information.
Glad to help, Jeff. Enjoy planning your van life adventure.
So, folks, that was Microsoft's AI co-pilot, which is now free for everyone, by the way. You can go to bing.com/chat and just chat away at this thing all day if you want. But honestly, it's a pretty good search engine in this context. And I think everything it said was pretty good. Now, a couple of bits of context, though. Things have changed recently between Canada and the U.S. And I think that if you are a USAEN, and I use that term because the Canadians do not actually like the term American so much. I mean, that varies, but I've heard some say that. Don't be going with American flags flying everywhere. And, you know, this is not a time for that. This is a time to be very respectful and enjoy the hospitality they have to offer. I think you're not going to run into problems, but if you went into a bar late on a Saturday night and you were wearing, you know, your America's number one shirt, you would be increasing your chances of an encounter that you may not like. Also, the borders can be tricky. Don't forget, you got a border to go both ways, right? So you have to go up and back. In my experience, going to Canada is pretty easy. They ask you some questions. Obviously, you should not have any hint of a firearm in your vehicle. No firearms are allowed. That will get you turned around pretty quick. Also, marijuana, while it may be legal in Vermont and legal in Canada, crossing the border with it's another matter. So don't have that. And also a couple things that might not be obvious, like pepper spray. So while bear spray is allowed, to the best of my knowledge, pepper spray isn't, or mace, or anything like that. Anything you would have as a spray, as a personal protectant, that is not allowed. And they may ask you, and if you say you do have it, and I recommend that, you know, you don't want to get caught with it. But if they say, do you have any pepper spray? And you actually do, you think, oh, yes, I'm sorry, I forgot it. Well, they might confiscate it, or they might send you back to get rid of it and come back or whatever. But don't lie to the border agents. That's a bad idea. Coming back to the U.S., yeah, they can be a little bit rougher, and it can take longer. And I've had my van searched on the U.S. side, but not going into Canada. I've actually, the Americans, I'm sorry, the USAEans are much more likely to search. So, you know, things are a little weird right now. So keep that in mind should you head up to Canada. But man, Canada's beautiful and it's big. If you think driving across Texas is huge, try driving to Vancouver from the Maritime Province. I want to spend a whole lot more time up there. And yes, the fuel prices are a concern. But so what? You only live once. What's money for other than to spend it? So thanks for the question about Canadian van life. I wish I knew more about it, but I hope you enjoyed my little chat here with Copilot. Resource recommendation. Boy, I've got two of them here. I'm going to just go with one. One of the things I really wish I could help you guys out with is finding remote jobs, because that seems to be a big key to van life for so many people. And I'm just not a great resource for it, even though I've had quote-unquote remote jobs since I stopped working for AOL in 1999. I think every job I've had since then has been remote. I'm not necessarily good at finding them. I've just happened upon them in most cases. So if you're somebody who wants to do van life, needs to be employed, as most people do, and don't know exactly how to do it, I have a resource here that might be helpful, but you're going to have to evaluate on your own. It's one of many YouTube channels that focuses on this content. And I watched this video and I thought it was interesting because the title is 9 Boring But High-Paying Remote Jobs That Are Always Hiring. If a job is keeping you from doing van life, it might be a good strategy not to look for that dream job of doing whatever you want, what you always wanted to do, but just looking for a job that will actually get you some money. And these are actual jobs. This isn't doing DoorDash or anything like that. These are actual jobs where you will be an employee and you will be doing things that are fairly boring. And the advantage to you as a van lifer is that this fairly boring aspect means there's a lot of turnover. And if there's a lot of turnover, that means they're always hiring. And so I'm going to link to you to this video. It's from a guy by the name of Shane Hummus. He's got 1.15 million subscribers. He's a big time YouTuber. This video that I will link has 3.7 million views since December. So he's got something going here. But some of the things he talked about were things like medical transcription and insurance adjusting and things that just require a lot of data entry type of things. And so to do any of these jobs, basically all you'd need is either a phone or an internet connection, and you could do these jobs just as effectively in your van as you could out on the road. And then you can just be wherever you want. Most of the ones here, you don't ever have to go into the office, or if you do, it's, you know, once in a while. And I think it would be a great way to start out. If you needed to have some income coming in to do your van life, well, this might be a good place to start. So I'm going to link to the video. It's called 9 Boring But High-Paying Remote Jobs, Always Hiring in 2025. I think you should give it a look. And he's very good at explaining all the pros and cons of these jobs, tells you how to apply for them, what you need for them, and all that kind of stuff. And then he ranks them as what he thinks are the best jobs. So 9 Boring But High-Paying Remote Jobs. I hope this will help somebody out who's looking for a way to do van life but is stopped by the fact that they can't find a remote job. I know it's much harder now than it was when I started this podcast in 2019 or so. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 248. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. For those wondering how I'm doing with this recovery from the stupid surgery, I still can't walk. I won't be able to walk for another 2 weeks. And once I can do that, then I hope to get back to my van and start actually living the life, at least to some extent, once again. Until next time, remember the words of Donald Miller, who said, "Fear is a manipulative emotion that can trick us into living a boring life."